you know, as a singer and as a baritone also, it's interesting that you get the lead as a baritone in this. So that's not something that happens quite as often as for baritones in opera, I believe.
No, you're right. I think it's a special thing. And I mean, although there are some operas out there that the main character is the baritone. I mean, you have Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, which is probably the biggest one that comes to mind, where the main characters, the main male characters, are all baritones. But in general, no, it's mostly from what people understand or people who watch or go to see operas, it's normally the bad guy is the baritone, and then the hero is the tenor. But I wouldn't necessarily call Fantastic Fox a hero. He's sort of, you know, he's a special character. So, and he's not technically just a baritone. there's some notes in there where he could go either way. He's a tenor. He's a baritone. Sometimes it's a little, it's high. It definitely sits high.
Is that when? This might be a spoiler alert, but when he gets his tail shot off, maybe.
yeah, he's definitely he's yelping and he's screaming. But no, it's just the way that Tobias Picker likes to write. I think he likes to see the tops and the bottoms of the voice, which is really special. A lot of composers, you know, sort of live in the middle range of the voice of the fach. And he takes it to the extremes, you know, the upper partials and the lower partials, and as well in the middle. But that's what's sort of fun. It's like a roller coaster ride. And once you get it, once it's in your voice, it's really this sort of like special thing to sing. It feels really unique.
So describe the character of Mr. Fox then for me.
Well, he's fantastic.
Of course he is.
He's a great character, and the way that they have him depicted is he's very family-oriented, but he's also very self-motivated. And he wants to, you know, help his family out, help his wife, feed them, and do all the things that he has to do to take care of his family. But at the same time, he wants to outsmart the humans. This is a sort of main goal for him. And he does it. And that's the amazing thing. That's the fantastic thing, is that he actually, as an animal, has the ability to outsmart the humans who are trying to kill him. He's not trying to kill them. He's just trying to feed his family. But the fantastic thing is that he's just an animal who has the ability to outsmart the humans. And it's that sort of theme is kind of special, you know, and there's a lot within that idea. It's like, you know, does nature really have this ever-present, you know, ability to sort of communicate, and it's beyond, you know, our scope. It's beyond our thinking. It's, you can't just rip up a den out of the ground and expect the animals to be dead. They have instinct. They know, you know, it's this amazing underlying story of nature versus humans who are trying to, you know, take it away from them.
And there's parallels to the real world then too, when you talk about, you know, people being displaced even, you know, I think.
Yeah, exactly. It definitely, yes, because if you think about it in that way, these big farms and these guys who are all interested in money are coming in. And if you look at the fox less as a animal, more as like, a person in the woods who lives, you know, alone with his family and provides for them, they're pushing him out, you know, they're pushing him away, which is that's a very interesting angle to take as well. But for the fox himself, in terms of his characterisms, he's confident, he's funny, he's got a lot of energy, he is sort of fabulous in his attire. I think I'll talk about this in a minute, but the way that it's designed is just so cool, and it really depicts what I felt the fox should look like and most of the characters should look like. So he's got all these great attributes, and he's smart, and he's fun, and he's loving. So he's a really great character to play, and to also, I guess, see from the audience's perspective. He's going to be a really great character to follow.
Yeah, you can see if you go online to the Tobin's website, or if you go to our website at tbrclassical.org, the story that's up there about Fantastic Mr. Fox. You can see the costume designs and the sketches that are on there, and there's this kind of patchwork of costuming that that you get to wear as Mr. Fox, which is really, you know, wonderful to look at.
Yeah, yeah, it's very unique and special for me to see a illustration by Emily Carew Woodard, which are amazing, go from an illustration to an exact costume. And it's not a designer. She's not a, you know, costume designer. She's illustrating for books and stuff like that, from what I understand. So that is super unique for me. And I think it's going to speak volumes for the production. And I hope, and I believe that it's going to be visually stunning, especially in that smaller space, because people are going to get so intimate with the costumes and with the characters and with the set pieces and everything. It's going to look like a storybook has come to life, which is so special, and especially for kids, you know, because this is, if you want to make it really accessible for children, I think the visual aspect is going to be extremely important. But I really feel like it's just going to be a slam dunk. For Opera San Antonio, it's going to be really great.
Is this your first role that you've sung that is for a family opera, so to speak?
No, I actually developed a program for kids, a school program, mm-hmm. When I was at school at Juilliard with some of my friends. Tobias Greenhall was another baritone singing around, and Armand Rangeberon, who's a composer. The three of us, we worked for about 4 years at school, basically composing and writing a piece called Operation Superpower, Discovering Your Superpower. So it's a superhero opera for kids. And it was part opera, part motivational program, part anti-bullying assembly program that we took to schools. We have a lot of really great messages that we have in the show. Of course, there's singing, there's movement, there's piano playing, and it really is this sort of bigger than life experience. So no, but this is, to your question, this is not my first time performing for kids. We performed last fall. We teamed up with a company called Young Audiences, mm-hmm. and we performed the show over 70 times in schools. So I had quite a bit of experience performing for kids, and I really love it.
Now, when you're singing and when you're performing for kids, obviously you're doing a role while you're on stage, but at the same time, is there a tendency to want to gauge their reaction, to look out at them almost, to see how they're reacting to you as you perform?
Absolutely. I mean, it more than I think with adults, because adults don't normally
they're not as demonstrative.
Yeah, they don't express their every emotion all the time, but for kids, they really do. They're either with you 100% or they're not very much, not really with you, and that can really read. And when that reads, you get, like with the other program that I was doing, it was we always had to sort of gauge where the kids were and if they were following us, and we'd have to bring them back in. But with an opera piece that's fully composed and through composed and written through, that flexibility isn't necessarily there. We can't just sort of stop and talk to the kids and talk to the audience. This is a story that's going to be ongoing. So all I can really do in this situation is just continue to play and try and find ways, I guess, to be more interactive or connect more with the audience. But I feel like addressing the audience is going to be important, just with maybe not so much verbally, but with my eyes, with my actions, as if they are, if we know that they're there, because in the beginning, there's a whole introduction. That's how the opera starts, is if it, you know, we've broken the fourth wall immediately. Mrs. Fox comes out and she introduces who we are and everything. So there is that factor. Mm-hmm. We are giving a show. We are telling the story to this group of people, which is great, because if it wasn't there, then we would really just be in the story the whole time. So that gives me a flexibility to sort of communicate to the audience directly, look at them in the eye, bring them into the story, make them a part of the story rather than it just being a sort of isolated thing.
Cool. What are some of your favorite roles to play?
I just sang the role of Papageno last summer in The Magic Flute. That was a lot of fun. I'm going to be doing that again, reprising it in Edmonton, Canada, Alberta, Canada, in January. It's going to be cold. It's going to be really cold. That was a great role. I think I'll probably do that for the rest of my life. I feel very close to that character, and I could see myself just continuing to perform it. I haven't quite, you know, gotten the repertoire up to say, you know, this is my favorite role, that's my favorite role. More so, I think the roles that I would love to do, I think that's probably more where I'm at right now, are roles like Pelléas, Debussy's Pelléas, which is Debussy's only opera, or probably the only really well-known opera. That's an amazing piece, and it's very much in the range for my voice. Figaro in Il Barbiere di Siviglia, so Rossini's Figaro. And I mean, things in the future would be, say, Amfortas in Parsifal, Wagner's Parsifal. I saw Parsifal at the Met this past season, or maybe even two seasons ago, and it was just life-changing. I've seen a lot of Wagner operas, actually. I've seen two Wagner operas at Bayreuth, which is kind of like a crazy experience to have already. I've seen two. I saw Meistersinger and Tristan und Isolde. And I like Meistersinger, but Tristan is just not my... I can't get into it for some reason. Maybe sometime at a different point in my life, I'll find a way. But Parsifal was, you know, by far the best experience I've had seeing a Wagner opera. It was totally brilliant.
So what is the thing about a role that makes you feel a connection to it then?
I guess it's the, you know, what type of character is being played in the opera, and obviously the music has a really big thing to do with it. If it speaks to me and I can visualize myself on stage being a part of this production or being in that music and emoting the things that character has to convey, that's something that I feel very connected to. And for, you know, Figaro, it's obvious. I think, you know, not just vocally, but in the character, I can totally portray a young, I guess, entrepreneurial character. And for Pelléas, you know, that's another opera where, you know, the baritone plays the lead role.
Yeah.
You know, they sometimes, you know, baritone or tenor, it's definitely, that's another baritenor type role, but it's really sort of a special scenario. And you know, the young lover, that's a really cool character to play. But it's the music, it's the character, it's the emotions, it's a whole bunch of things that really kind of inspire me to want to be in the character. But then at the end of the day, it's also who's going to hire me.
Yeah.
And how much is it going to be worth, you know, my time, the money and all that stuff. That's important, you know, especially coming out of college and whatnot.
Well, speaking of emotional connection to roles, though, and upcoming projects, you have what I think is just sounds like something fascinating, which is a series of works that are based on letters, I guess, and writings from World War I. Is that correct? I mean, am I understanding this correctly?
I don't know if it's so much letters as much as it is the people, the people who fought in the war or were either living during the time and were very vocal during the time, but it's the composers who were alive during the war. Most of them in the program actually fought in the war. Some of them died in the war. So there's a whole sort of different varying degree of their involvement but obviously we're in the centennial year of World War One. And I just thought it would be a great way to build a program and connect people to the story of the war and give them an idea of what it was all about through music. Because music, unlike, you know, an article or a history book, it gives you a poetic poetic look into that world, into that time. Also, it takes you back musically, which is amazing because you are transported into a different time. And the text for some of these songs, I mean, I'm doing George Butterworth's Shropshire Lad.
Yeah.
And I'm starting the program with that. And it's going to be killer. You know, it's the stuff that's talked about in that the lads in their hundreds. I mean, the lads that will never be old. I mean, that's one, the name of the song. It's such a heartbreaking melody, a heartbreaking piece. And there is definitely going to be tears, maybe from even myself and my pianist, because of how deep we're going to go with these songs. And there's definitely going to be tears from the audience, and that's what I want. I want people to appreciate it beyond just, you know, text or historical fact or even, you know, Hollywood versions of it. I want people to experience it in this sort of true kernel of emotion. This is somebody who experienced the war, who had incredible talent and abilities to depict it in music and words, which is so, you know, special. It's going to be an undertaking, and I'm ready for it because I've been doing a lot of recital work, and this is the first program where I've taken a theme and I've really built it out, and I've spent, you know, several months scouring the internet libraries, Naxos Music Library, Spotify, all these different, you know, resources to really find the perfect setup.
Well, and World War One, beyond being such a giant conflict, and this is going to sound kind of strange to say, but besides being a horrible war, it was nevertheless good for artists in a way, so to speak, because there was a lot of writing that came out of people who were in the trenches at World War One, because there was nothing else to do there. But then it was a war that touched the entirety of the continent and America as well. And so there were a lot more people that were responding to this war than, say, what had previously been isolated conflicts around the globe. And so there was a lot of art that came out of World War One.
I mean, it was really the sort of formations of globalization, mm-hmm. right? It's like this is the world coming together. For better or for worse, you have Americans in France and, you know, the British in France, and people just mixing, and yeah. Their cultures mixing. So there's, you know, whereas the dictators and the, you know, people of power are fighting and using people to fight against each other. There's that really special story about, you know, Silent Night.
Yeah.
The ceasefire during Christmas. And since my first recital will be right before Christmas, it's December 10th. It's in, you know, at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. I mean, this is just, it's too perfect to not do. I'm definitely going to be presenting some of, you know, those songs, maybe even as an encore, we'll sing Silent Night or something like that. But that's going to be a really special moment. I probably won't be able to recreate that again, you know, but I definitely want to have, I want that to be a part of it, because within all of this sort of, you know, I guess violence and tragedy, there is also the kernel of hope and what was to come in the 20th century, and what built upon it, and all this, you know, what changed, you know, so much changed. war is a terrible thing. We all know that, but you know, it brings people together in a weird, weird way. So there, that is also explained in a lot of the songs as well. I can assure you. So, yeah, I'm very, very excited for this, and I hope people feel me on the program. I hope they get what I'm trying to get what I'm trying to do. I'm sure they will.
Well, John Brancy, thanks so much, and we look forward to seeing you in Fantastic Mr. Fox, and good luck with your continued future projects as well.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.